Lord, I'm just crazy.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. I just realized I forgot to get a mic set up for my fellow in the studio today, Dr. Paul Stanwood. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Robin.
Good. And on the phone, I have Jeet. Hello, Jeet.
Hey, it's good to be here again, Robin.
Good to have you, Jeet. You are a regular fixture here. If we were Cheers, you would have a stool, and it would be your stool, and no one else could take it. I don't know if that was a very good.
Do it by phone.
So I have two special guests here today because we're going to talk about a specific book, Robert Crumb's Genesis, and both of my guests come from different, specialties of knowledge. Jeet being a, I was having a conversation with Seth the other day when he was in town, and he said you're a treasure for comics.
Oh, that's very kind.
Because of your academic and endeavors into kind of the establishing comics and that kind of dialogue and conversation. And Dr. Paul Stanwood here is a professor in the English department at University of British Columbia. And your specialty, tell me if I'm wrong, is specifically Renaissance and classical literature?
That's it, yes.
There we
Earlier
go.
Earlier 17th century English literature especially.
And I took a class with Paul last fall, that was, a year ago, in classical and biblical literature. And when this book came out, when Crumb's book came out, I kind of thought this would be interesting to have a dialogue about this, looking at the context of reinterpreting biblical text now and there's something that really struck me in the class where you were just talking about how literature, traditions within literature, I guess, and how literature kind of follows on in different traditions, but it all kind of has a root and it all kind of connects, and that's kind of stuck with me in comics.
Yes.
So Robert Crumb's specific choice with Genesis kind of interweaves the two, I guess?
Yes, I'm sure it does.
That's right, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the Dr. Stanwood, just from his CV, has written a lot about John Donne and George Herbert, who are like the sort of great religious poets in the English tradition.
Yeah, so, that's right.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, religion has played a very strong role in both literature and in the visual arts, and Crumb sort of brings the two together. So I'm sure we'll have an interesting conversation.
Yes, I'm sure we will. Of course, this is earlier than anything. This, what, 2,000 years before the Common Era? So the Greeks were not even thinking about such matters.
Mm-hmm. So, well, one of the interesting things that we were discussing beforehand is that the book doesn't feel religious.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Robin. It's interesting because I'm sure that many of the writers Professor Stanwood teaches were coming out of, like, you know, out of theology. You know, John Donne
yes.
was a preacher, and Herbert was a very religious man, as was Milton. Whereas, you know, we're sort of, well, there's still many religious people in the world today, but we're also living in a sort of post-Christian world where there are many secular people. And what's interesting is that despite secularism, the interest in the Bible hasn't diminished. That I was thinking about this because Crumb is doing Genesis, and there's a lot of books I've read by fairly secular writers that use religious themes. I was just reading a book of poetry by Katha Pollitt, an American poet, and there's a whole suite of poems that are based on the Bible, and she's a very secular writer.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting phenomena, the sort of persistence of religious literature in, you know, arguably a post-religious
mm-hmm.
age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. But Genesis, after all, has been read and reread and been thought about, you mm-hmm. know, for centuries, hasn't it? I'm impressed by the some of the remarkable figures, like the serpent, in chapters, well, 1, 2, and 3.
Mm-hmm.
If Milton were thinking of a serpent, I don't think he could do better than this one.
Yeah, no, I mean, the serpent is interesting, and perhaps we should maybe describe it, because one of the features of the Genesis story is that the serpent, we have to presume, had some sort of, like, arms and legs, because it,
yeah.
the serpent is cursed by having to crawl on the ground. So
yeah,
the supposition
right.
is that prior to being
mm-hmm.
cursed, when it was in the Garden of Eden, the serpent, you know, had, which is the way that Crumb describes it, sort of as a science fiction type lizard, and it really, he captures perhaps in the portrayal of the serpent the sort of slithering evil
yes.
and sort of the demonic energy of the serpent.
Yes, I'm sure that's true. He does, or he, she, it
mm-hmm.
becomes really rather pathetic in that that image.
Mm-hmm.
On your belly shall you crawl in dirt, shall you eat all the days of your life, and so on. Looks like a kind of innocent garter snake, doesn't it, in the book, where before the serpent really is, you know, he's wonderfully anthropomorphic. He really is, well.
One thing I'm curious about leading into Genesis is, in order to tell the story, you kind of have to pick your translation. Was it Robert Alter?
Oh, yes.
That Crumb chose. And that was based on original Torah or another translation?
No, Robert Alter, who actually visited us at UBC a year ago, had a good deal to say about his own translation. He feels that there weren't any translations that are adequate apart from his own. And he may well be right. The translation he makes of Genesis does seem, to me, really very interesting, lively, and I should have thought quite accurate. He's very close, isn't he?
Yeah, that's right. Well, I think
he's a Hebrew scholar after all.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think one point to perhaps make is that, like, ideals of translation change over time.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, the translation that perhaps most of us are familiar with is the King James translation, which is also itself based on earlier translations from Wycliffe. But the thing is that it was written at a time where they had, you know, marvelous sense of language. It was the age of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, they didn't have the scholarly resources that we do today.
Mm.
And especially, like, in the given the last century or two of work in archaeology, and also the real renaissance of Hebrew as a living language.
Yes. I think Crum was very wise to choose Alter's translation.
That's right, yeah. So, I mean, Alter's aim is for a real fidelity to the Hebrew, even at the expense of, like, easy understanding. That the ideal is that, you know, these are very important words, so even if they don't, like, flow smoothly, we want to get as close as we can to an English equivalent. And Crumb's choice tells us something about that. He doesn't completely keep with Alter, though. At certain points, he sort of harkens back to the King James for the sort of the literary resonance, or perhaps the poetic power.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, occasionally he does.
Mm-hmm.
Though generally, the language moves very nicely. It's quite colloquial.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more approachable for more people, I'd have thought, who would pick this book up to read it in this translation. Every word is here, as far as I know, that occurs in Genesis.
One review I read, because I haven't read Alter's text itself, I read a review by John Updike where he, one of the criticism I think was the overuse of footnotes, and I guess in this case, does Crumb's illustration replace that descriptive aspect and make it a little more palatable?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Yeah. Go
ahead, G.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's very true. I don't think Updike's criticism of Alter is really just in that sense, because I think one of the things that Alter is trying to do is to suggest that biblical Hebrew is very resonant and also has a lot of, like, ambiguity, or there's a lot of meaning, layered meanings within the words.
Oh, yes, that's
and
very true.
So his textual commentary was very sort of necessary, and I found it very helpful. And Crumb's, but you're right that Crumb's pictures sort of take the place of the footnotes. The pictures themselves are sort of commentary on it, because obviously the Bible has no pictures. And so any pictures that someone does, any illustration of the Bible is also an interpretation of the Bible.
That's very true. Well, there are pictures, but none so sequential as here.
Yeah.
There are various pictures pictures that people have imagined.
That's right, yeah. There's a long tradition of people visualizing the Bible and of illustrating the Bible, but I'm just talking about the Hebrew text as it stands,
yes,
right?
Indeed.
It's purely text, and it comes, maybe you can say this better than I do, but it maybe comes out of a tradition that distrusts images to a certain degree.
Yes, I think you're right. Yes, that's true. The images are the imagined pictures that I've been familiar with, that I've seen in the past, are mostly those highly romanticized, visualized things that soften and give a kind of nice patina to the events. There's nothing like that in Crumb's imagination of the text. Is there? This is not a romanticized view of Genesis.
No, that's very true. And I think that's a really important point to make, that I think Crumb was partially responding to earlier traditions of visualizing the Bible, and especially of sort of the earlier comic book versions of the Bible that he grew up with. There's a famous series in the 50s, Picture Stories from the Bible, which not only tended to have those romanticized images, but they also tended to take out things that might offend or upset people. So the story of Noah and his sons, there's no mention of Ham seeing the nakedness of his father. And DC Comics, the wonderful people that give you Superman and Batman, in the early 70s, they did a picture version of the Bible as well, And from their account, the sin of the men of Sodom is that they were greedy. They came up to Lot and they asked for money, which is not so. So Krem is responding to this tradition to balderize or to soften the Bible. And there's also a kind of interesting aspect too that he's bringing an ethnicity to the Bible. That a lot of these earlier visualizations of the Bible imagine the biblical characters as you know white Anglo-Saxon North Europeans, you know, blonde with blue eyes.
That's right, and they're rather nicely dressed as well.
Yeah, and so, I mean, this in that sense alone, it's a more historical Bible because the people in his version very much are Middle Eastern. They look like the people you would meet in that part of the world, which is obviously a very conscious decision on his part.
Yeah, I'm sure that's very much the case. I remember one picture particularly of Abraham and Isaac in an early Bible I was given as a child. Abraham is about to slay Isaac, of course, but it all looks, you know, like the sort of thing one would do on a Sunday afternoon. And I think Crumb does very much avoid that sort of thing. So, yeah, I should we say something more about the ethnicity as a good point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, do you have something to add to that, or?
Sure, yeah. I mean, I think that there is a an interesting aspect with both the Jewishness and then also perhaps the Arabness as well, because Crumb takes seriously the interpretation that Ishmael was the father of the Arabs. And if you look at his rendition of the genealogy of Ishmael and the descendants that came from Ishmael,
yes,
they do sort of have Arab type features, or more particularly Arab type dress.
Yes.
So that's a very sort of interesting choice to make. Part of this perhaps comes from the fact that Krem himself, although he's not Jewish himself, is married to a Jewish artist, Aileen Kominsky Crum. Mm. There's that element perhaps played a part, but also I think that this goes back to the issue of the translation, that just as Alter is trying to have a fidelity to Hebrew,
yes,
rather than the sort of English literary tradition, Crum is trying to have a fidelity to the Hebrew ethnicity. It's part of this attempt,
yes,
to have a sort of historical or a more historical Bible.
Yes, that's true.
It's kind of a cultural, mm-hmm, specific cultural decision.
Yeah.
And Crum was raised Catholic, wasn't he?
That's right. Crum was raised Catholic. And if we want to talk about, I mean, I think he's left that a long time ago.
Yeah.
And he's very much interested in spiritual matters. He's has often in his stories talked about, you know, sort of pondering these sort of existential questions of faith and the purpose of the universe. And, you know, prior to this,
yeah,
one of his most powerful stories was where he illustrated the mystic visions of Philip K. Dick,
mm-hmm,
the American science fiction writer. So I think it's fair to say that Crum has a long-standing interest in sort of mysticism and religion, and I think a respectful interest. Like, I think we said earlier, this is not the book of drawn by a believer, but it's drawn by somebody who takes, you know, religion seriously.
Of course he does.
Yeah,
I see. He was raised in a secular household, headed by, I'm reading from a few notes from Globe and Mail review of a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Raised in a secular household that was headed by a rigidly strict former U.S. Marine father who was actually a closeted atheist.
Uh-huh.
Interesting, a closeted atheist.
Oh.
Mr. Crum was sent off to Catholic school at age 6 because his father had always admired the discipline Roman Catholic nuns were famous for instilling in their students. We never got a lot of religion at home, Mr. Crum says of himself and his siblings, but we certainly got the whole indoctrination and brainwashing in school. And so 60 years on, he's about 65 now,
mm-hmm,
here he is with this rather complicated story of Genesis. A good place? No, he's saying. No, it's not a good place to look for spiritual guidance or moral guidance. Genesis? I don't believe it's the Word of God. Well, but still, the stories are powerful, and he doesn't mean to belittle them in any way, but to tell things so far as he can the way they are.
On that note, I'm going to do a quick song break, and we'll be right back.
Okay, great.
God said to Abraham, kill me a son. Abe said, man, you must be putting me on. God said, no. Abe said, what? God said, you can do what you want, Abe, but next time you see me coming, you better run. Sam, he had a bloody nose. Welfare department, they wouldn't give him no clothes. They asked poor Howard, where can I go? Howard said, there's only one place I know. Sam said, tell me quick, man, I got to run. Said to Louis the King, I got 40 red, white, blue shoestrings and 1,000 telephones that don't ring. Do you know where I can get rid of these things? And Louis the King said, let me think for a minute, son. Then he said, yes, I think it can be easily done. Just take everything down to Highway 61. One right. My complexion, she says, is much too white. He said, come here and step into the light. He says, you're right. Let me tell the second mother this has been done. But the second mother was with the seventh son, and they were both out on Highway 61. Was very bored trying to create a next world war. He found a promoter who nearly fell off the floor. He said, I never engaged in this kind of thing before, but yes, I think it can be very easily done.
And we're back, Ink Studs, CITR 101.9 FM. I've got two special guests with me this week. I have Cheat here, Ink Studs regular, and noted Canadian comics expert. And I've got Dr. Paul Stanwood from the UBC English Department. And we're talking about Robert Crumb and Genesis. That was Bob Dylan's Highway 61, which I kind of, or Highway 61 Revisited. Is it just Highway 61? Highway 61 Revisited, there we go, which I kind of chose specifically because it kind of fits with the conversation, because the song is basically about Abraham and Isaac, well, the beginning is, and which fits with what we're doing. It's reinterpreting old stories in new versions, and Bob Dylan, being a Jewish musician, would have grown up, I don't know how secular his household was growing up, do you know, Jeet?
My sense of it is fairly secular. He himself had a religious turn a little bit later in his life, but that wasn't from his background.
That was
but
born
I think
again,
it's actually perhaps relevant because Bob Dylan was one of, you know, the great singers to emerge from the '60s, which is also the year that Crumb first came into prominence as a cartoonist. And so in that sense, there's some commonality in the sense that I actually think the 60s generation, although they're seen as being rebels against the established social order, were also perhaps rebelling against what they saw as the spiritual sterility of 1950s America, the sort of post-war America, mm-hmm. with Crumb with his, you know, marine closet atheist father, you know, who just wanted to, you know, use Catholic indoctrination as a power tool. So there was like a sense in which in the 60s, among the counterculture, you had a turn towards the spiritual. Perhaps a cheesy example of this is the musical Jesus Christ Superstar.
Slightly feeble, but points well taken.
One more direct example is Ginsberg, who was a huge Beats were all pretty big influence on Crumb.
That's right, yeah. Ginsberg is an excellent example because his poetry is saturated with especially sort of the Hebrew Bible.
And the prophets, Jeremiah, he had a psychotic episode where he thought he was Jeremiah at one point, I think.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So in that sense, we can perhaps contextualize Crumb's decision to do Genesis as part of that sort of story of the 1960s generation and the rediscovery of spirituality and of these religious traditions by people who didn't necessarily grow up in, you know, very religious households.
Now, at the back, Crumb provides his own footnotes mm-hmm. On his work. I guess I'm almost using footnotes kind of liberally because one thing that kind of bothers me within the footnotes is he makes a lot of points but doesn't cite his points.
Mm-hmm.
But that's another discussion, yeah. I guess. What we're going to talk about, or what I'm wondering about, is the specific points he makes, and one is the discussion of matriarchy
mm-hmm.
within the book. Do you feel he does it justice? How do you feel about the role of matriarchy in Crumb's adaptation? Either of you?
I mean, there's kind of a lot to say there. I mean, the footnotes are not as detailed as, say, Robert Alter is. These are not scholarly footnotes.
No, they're really comments about chapter by chapter, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Having said that, he does make some interesting points about where he's getting some of his ideas, and especially it's useful in pointing out that he relied on a Hebrew scholar, Savina Tubal, who wrote a number of books about the biblical matriarchs, especially Sarah and Hagar. And Tubal has had one of her basic points is that there was a matriarchal tradition as well as a patriarchal tradition. And she actually made a very interesting point, which is that we tend to think of the genealogies in the Hebrew Bible as the patriarchs. It's like, you know, Abraham begat, you know, so-and-so who begat so-and-so. And it seems like it's an all-male line. But she said that if you actually look at the main family stories of who is being followed in Genesis, these are all the descendants of Sarah. There's a little
That's
bit
right,
about
yes.
the descendants of Hagar, who are, you know, like sort of peripheral members. But so one of the points that Tubal made is that this is very much a society where hereditary is traced along matriarchal lines. And this perhaps gives us some indication of the role and power of women as keepers of cultural tradition.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Savina Tubal and Sarah the Priestess.
That's right.
1984, yeah. Who exposes the underlying, buried, hidden, distorted sense of these stories about the women. Sarah, mm-hmm. Rebecca, Rachel, Leah, all very cogently.
Mm-hmm.
I was struck by the fact that never quite occurred to me that Abraham had, what, some six further descendants who just vanish.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing ever is said of them.
That's right. The Genesis is very much interested in who comes out of the line of Sarah.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is a very sort of important point. Now, of course, you know, this being scholarship, there's always controversy, and there's many people who have said that, you know, Tubal's work is very speculative and whatnot. But I read it when I was working on my review of Crumb, and it's certainly very suggestive. And I think that she is onto something that even within the text of Genesis itself, you can see that there was a matriarchal background. At one point, one of the patriarchs orders the women in his household to destroy their idols.
Well, that's right.
So it's
yes.
very clear that they had been bringing these household idols, which are the exactly what in that type of society the women would guard, right?
Yes, they're looking after them, aren't they?
Mm. That's right. Yeah. So, and certainly Genesis is one important point is that, like all the biblical books, it's a polemical book. That it's very much written to set a certain point of view across, and also to polemicize against other points of view. So throughout Genesis, there's sort of polemics against polytheism, right? There's the suggestion of, like, why, you know, this God is the real God, and, like, all the other gods.
It's monotheistic, isn't it?
It's monotheistic.
So, yeah.
And I think that there is a sort of patriarchal polemic within it, but simply because there's a... But we have to think that if there's a patriarchal polemic, it has to... counter something. There has to be a matriarchal counter-argument that it's going against, right?
Yes.
So we can read this text against the grain and see that despite the fact that it's heavily patriarchal, it does have take place in a context that also included matriarchal tradition.
Yes. Obviously, a number of women are significant,
yeah,
and they have to be discovered. When they aren't there, we must find them.
Mm-hmm.
There's that section, isn't there? In my reading through the book, I was struck again by how very episodic Genesis is,
mm-hmm.
And also seeing certain episodes next to each other makes one realize how, in a way, rather incoherent a good bit of Genesis actually is.
Yeah.
The first two chapters, they're two accounts of creation, very
mm-hmm.
clearly, obviously.
Yeah.
Although some wouldn't like to say so.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's clear that there are, from these illustrations, one recognizes, well, here we have, at the end of chapter one,
mm-hmm.
There they are, Adam and Eve. And then we seem to start all over again in chapter 2.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, no. There are, like, a number of sort of contradictions in the text. And the point is exactly right, that one of the side effects of being illustrated is that these sort of come to the fore, that you can't... Like, when we're reading, we perhaps glide
yes.
over... Like, you know, what's actually happening in the story?
I think that's very true.
Yeah,
yes.
So in some ways the illustrations force us to slow down, and also force us to perhaps be thinking more along the lines of what exactly is happening here.
Some of the illustrations are indeed rather curious and graphic. They are quite anthropomorphic, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
How do you depict God? Apart from all this long hair.
Mm-hmm. No. It's very true that that's a kind of also a sort of paradox within the sort of monotheistic tradition that later on in the Bible we have very much a sense that God is outside of space and time, that he is this sort of, he's holy other, to use
yes.
the language of theology.
That's
and you
right.
can't see God, like not even Moses could see the face of God. But in the early chapters of Genesis, you know, God is like a regular guy. He's walking around, you know.
He's your uncle that shows up and tells you what to do.
That's right, yeah. He's like very present. So in that sense, like even to illustrate God is very much a dramatic choice. I know, like,
yes.
Within certain religious traditions, the idea is that you can't illustrate God, right? Like, God cannot be shown because even his name can't really be said.
That's right. In the Tetragrammaton, you wouldn't do that. You can't even speak the name of God or write it.
That's right, yeah.
But here he is.
Yeah.
And clearly he has very, very strong views from time to time. He doesn't necessarily have any reason for what he does. I was thinking of there are instances where someone he doesn't like, and so he just zaps him, and that's that.
Mm-hmm. It seems like throughout the book, the God character gets nicer and nicer, or is less mean.
It's more remote.
Yeah,
is rather different. Obviously, in the last part of Genesis, God doesn't figure in the same way at all. What is it? From chapter 37 on to the end, Joseph and his mm-hmm. brothers.
Yeah.
That seems a very different and distinct part of Genesis, mm-hmm. Quite unlike most of what's gone before.
No, that's right, yeah. I mean, I don't know to what degree we want to talk about biblical scholarship. My sense is
I think we better not.
the text was not written at one point, because those people who study the sort of languages can pinpoint or at least try to pinpoint when things are written, and it's clear that this is not, you know, a coherent book written by one author. It's a collection of stories
yes.
that had pre-existed over several generations and then were yep. later brought together and then also heavily edited. I mean, that's the main thing, that the when Genesis was finally nailed down, there was a lot of sort of there's a very conscious decision in the final editors to include certain things and take certain things out.
Yes.
And so that later story of Joseph and his brother, it seems to fall into that era of Hebrew culture where God is more distant, where God might show up in a dream, mm-hmm. but, you know, he's not coming into your tent and you have to, like, you know, serve him food as you do in the time of Abraham.
Yeah, very much so.
How do you feel this works as a reinterpretation of biblical work as far as creating a new narrative? One thing I was thinking about, especially from the class with you, was the Milton, when we read the Samson Agonistes, which kind of expands the story of Samson quite substantially. Yes. Does this work in that same way of expanding Genesis in a way with Crumb and Alter's interpretations, kind of adding new light or new parts to stories?
That's hard to answer. I would have thought that what Crumb is doing is very close to what is there.
Mm-hmm.
What Milton does in Samson Agonistes is a decided departure from the Book of Judges. Crumb in no way departs from this book, but we're made to imagine through his pictures what's going on. And seeing in a way that probably one hasn't seen or perhaps even wanted to see. You know, so many of these characters are really rather ugly. They're not nice looking. Even Joseph, once he's shaved, Joseph doesn't look very, very nice. There's a certain similarity, a certain brutality about the figures. But, you know, that's just part of his visualization, but it's still all there. Also, you know, that many of the characters are rather short. Maybe that's appropriate for 2,000, 3,000 years ago. You notice how short Adam and Eve are next to God. Well,
that's interesting, though, because that would be a specific choice he'd make within how he characterizes the folks within the book.
Yeah.
So. Sure. And in fact, I think maybe one way to think about this is that there is a longstanding tradition, or many traditions within Western culture, of visualizing the Bible. And perhaps one dominant tradition is a heroic tradition. It's the tradition of sort of Michelangelo, you know?
Yes, that's... Oh, this is not Michelangelo, is it?
No. I mean, and Crumb in interviews very much talks about this. He says, you know, he can appreciate someone like Michelangelo, but he feels that Michelangelo is the ancestor of Frank Frazetta, where he himself sees himself as being the ancestor of Brugal, you know?
Yeah.
Crumb is working in the satiric, grotesque tradition, which hasn't, I mean, is a very vital tradition, but it hasn't often been used to illustrate the Bible. So perhaps that's one of the innovations.
Well, that's an important point to make, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of... Can you think of anyone else working in this sort of grotesque tradition? Like, Hogarth didn't illustrate the Bible, did he? Maybe...
I don't think so.
I don't think he did.
No. So I think that's a very interesting thing. Perhaps the one... visually, there are sort of echoes. Like, I do think... We talked about God before with the beard, and perhaps I'm wrong, but do you think that there's an element of William Blake in that?
There is, but that is one of the traditions, though, to depict God as a figure with long, streaming hair.
Mm-hmm.
That I think he does pick up
from,
you know, a tradition for sure.
Sure.
I'm wondering, on the line of tradition, as far what kind of influence would be from, like, say, Reformation-era depictions, especially with Reformation, because you had the argument of religious cultures, and so you had a lot of pretty brutal imagery there too. And I mean, that was more interpreting specific political figures within contexts of different books and stuff. But does that play a role?
I'm gonna let Zeet answer that. I'm not sure. Gee.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm not sure.
Or am I stretching it too far?
I mean, in terms of talking, like, the sort of Reformation, I think his very decision to visualize the Bible, it has to be seen as culturally specific, that not all cultures visualize the Bible.
No.
And there would be traditions that are very hostile to that, you know, going back to this sort of ancient Hebrew prohibition against graven images, but later there were sort of like iconoclastic movements in the Byzantine Empire and later in the Reformation. And then certainly now there's a long-standing prohibition in Islam. So the very fact that he thinks he started with the assumption that the Bible can be illustrated, you know, places him on one side of a cultural divide. And it's a cultural divide that is of long-standing.
What do you think of the importance of Crum doing this book as far as his first, like, I mean, here's arguably the most important cartoonist, and he chooses for his first real big book to be Genesis.
Yeah, well, no, that's an interesting point, because Crum's previous books are all been sort of collections of stories, and, like, he's never really done anything, you know, that's longer than 20 or 30 pages, aside from the Kafka book. But even that is sort of like short episodic.
And it was written by someone else.
It was written by someone else. So this is the longest solo work he's ever done. Now, having said that, some people have made this point that, you know, like, that Crumb, you know, only does, like, you know, 8 to 10 pages, and that's a sign that he hasn't, like, kept up with the age of the graphic novel with longer narratives. I myself have never been convinced by that argument. Like, I think 8 pages of Crumb can be equal to, like, 200 pages of someone else, right?
Yes.
Like, I actually think that the short works he's did, and certainly, like, you know, I would rather read 20 pages of Alice Munro than 400 pages of Stephen King. Like, I don't think the length, you know, dictates merit. But having said that, I think, you know, maybe at the back of Crumb's mind, it was a sense that, you know, I'm living in the age of, you know, Mouse, of Jimmy Corrigan, and many other graphic novels. And he's a fairly competitive guy, too. And, you know, he knows. So perhaps this is an attempt to, like, sort of, you know, upgrade himself for the age of the graphic novel, and really, like, perhaps triumph over everyone, because, you know, he's not just telling an autobiographical story or a fictional story. He's going back to, you know, like, the foundational book of Western civilization. So this is, I mean, if he has a competitive streak, one could certainly say that he's, like, telling every other cartoonist, well, can you top that?
Yes.
Yeah, and certainly, I mean, perhaps some of the poets that Professor Stanwood studies also had that competitive streak. Like, I would imagine that with someone like Milton, part of the choice of doing Paradise Lost is, you know, like, this is the one way that I can enter into competition with Virgil and Homer, right? Like, this
is
the one story that's powerful enough to put me in that league.
And it has to be in English.
That's right.
As well, yes.
And would you say the same with Dante and doing it in the Italian vernacular?
Yes, I'm sure that's the case. again. I was thinking of the your earlier comment about the Reformation. All sorts of scenes, of course, have been illustrated, mm-hmm. But mostly in, well, thinking of very early glass mm-hmm. and illustrations in English churches that I'm most familiar with seeing, you would see the flood or Noah depicted in again in a more romantic and delightful kind of way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wonder if one can ever think of Noah in quite the same way. You know, after all, what was the reason for the flood? This is very clear mm-hmm. in the illustration, isn't it? God decides that the world is wicked, mm-hmm. so we're going to get rid of it. And we all gather into the ark. Well, that's also a kind of children's game with the Noah and the ark. But nothing is said about how it happened to come about. And also the fact that even after the flood, everything returns to the way it was before. And I think Crumb has done very well to remind one of that. So I'm wondering indeed about his audience. Who all's reading this or affected by this? Mm-hmm. Well,
can that be answered easily right now, Jeet?
Well, no. I mean, I guess the book is in its early days, so its impact on the audience will probably be seen over time. But I mean, it is certainly selling very well. Like,
yes,
I saw it like on Amazon. It was like number 8, like up there with Dan Brown and other popular bestsellers.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
Yeah, yeah.
I gather the first printing is sold out.
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, I kind of would think that the majority of readers are the sort of perhaps secular people who, you know, want to know more about the Bible or have an interest in Crumb. I'd be curious, like, ultimately, like, the impact on religious readers. And I'd be very curious to see reviews by mm-hmm. religious readers and how they respond to it. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is a kind of irreverence. I was glad to see Professor Stanwood mention the Noah thing, because one of the things is that the cartoonist Paul Karazek pointed yes. out that Noah's three sons actually look a little bit like the Three Stooges. Yes. And if you know anything about the sons of Noah, like, it's a bit of an apt comparison.
Yeah, they're really very unsatisfactory characters.
Yeah.
Poor Ham.
Yeah. Well, yes.
But I actually think Crumb was perhaps influenced by the fact that Shem sounds a lot like Shemp,
yeah.
who is one of the mm-hmm. Three Stooges.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I really got a lot of was his interpretation of the Tower of Babel.
Babel, yeah.
Babel. That was really fascinating, where he'd use all the characters, like, he'd insert different languages in there to kind of add to that confusion yes. they'd feel at a certain point.
Mm-hmm. Where does he get this?
I think he uses, like, hieroglyphics and
yes.
just makes it up.
Yeah, I don't think it makes any real sense. That's probably the point.
Yeah.
These characters are all looking extremely angry and unhappy with each other, and they're all speaking different languages.
That's right.
God is very unhappy as he stands there overlooking the mm-hmm. the city.
Kind of like Godzilla.
A little like Godzilla.
Yeah.
Quite a little like, yeah. And
yeah.
then Babel is destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
And we see nothing more of it.
Now, you had some specific points that I saw that you had written up where Crumb had taken different liberties or different interpretations or expanded upon that.
Oh, no. I think the point I had made on a blog post thing was simply to note that there are a few occasional places where Crumb departs from Alter. Like, he, for, like, you know, 95% of the book, he's using Alter's translations.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few places where he uses sort of other language. Often he goes back to the sort of King James
Most
Bible.
Most of King James, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's usually in places in terms of the clarity of language where just to make the language more accessible. I think the one example I used in my review was where under Alter, a character says, "Am I instead of God who has denied you the fruit of the womb?" Whereas Crumb has, mm-hmm. "So then it's mm-hmm. me, not God, who has denied you the fruit of the womb." So the Crumb translation...
Yeah, it clarifies, doesn't it? Huh? It just clarifies.
Yeah, it just clarifies, yeah. Which is, yeah. So that's the main sort of point I made. And certainly, I think one reason he did that was, as you mentioned before, Alter has footnotes, literal footnotes at the bottom of the page, so that if there's something that seems awkward or odd, he explains very well like why he worded it that way. Mm-hmm. And whereas like Crumb doesn't have that liberty, so he feels it's better to have like a fluent translation.
He does in one part where I forget whose children it was, where he explained the name of the children, and I guess the literary puns within their names.
Oh mm-hmm. yes, that's right. What the names mean in the Hebrew.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
Whose children was that? I can't remember.
Well, there are several... it's a work of genealogy, isn't it? Genesis.
Yeah.
I rather like those pages of little pictures and names. That's partly what you're referring to. But there's mm-hmm. another place where... as Benjamin... That would be an obvious example.
That's right. Yeah.
Or here Isaac.
Yeah.
In chapter 21, Isaac, the Hebrew means he who laughs. That's the sort of thing he does occasionally.
That's right. Yeah.
That's good. I know Alter did remark that apart from his own translation of the Pentateuch, the best one is the King James Version. Mm-hmm. He dislikes virtually all modern translations. Of the Pentateuch, apart from his own, he made that very clear.
Yeah. No, I said that at many points, and I mean, to be fair, like I actually think he has a point. His translation is very much a great translation, and I think that one of the things to say on behalf of Alter is that there are many people who have the sort of Hebrew, but they don't have the English. That they know what the words mean, but they don't have the resources of English to translate it.
That's
and there are many
it.
People who have the English, but they don't have the Hebrew.
Exactly.
Alter is perhaps the one modern translator who is fluent in both Hebrew and English.
Yes, I'd like to think so, yes.
Yeah.
There's a certain sense of importance in creating your own translation, too.
Isn't that true, yes.
Go back to Martin Luther and...
Yes.
His
Sure. I mean, Alter clearly has a very proprietorial sense, and in his review in the New Republic, he did sort of say he wasn't like totally pleased that Crumb at points altered it. But I mean, I think that in this case, the proprietorial sense is justified, that he has good reason to be proud of what he did. I did make a point that I thought Alter had been influenced by the theories of Walter Benjamin. Who thought that translation should have some of the foreignness of the alien language. But mm-hmm. I've since found out that Alter vehemently disagrees with that, and he wants to make it clear that he was not influenced by Walter Benjamin.
Sure. That sounds very much like him, yes.
Yeah.
We're running up to the end of our time slot. Do either of you have any last comments on the book?
Well, I mean, I think we could certainly talk a lot more about it. There's a lot in the book, and I think it's a major book. Certainly one of the best comic books of the year. But even beyond that, I think the one thing I would advise readers is that Genesis is not like a novel. It's not like, Dan Brown or one of these paperback thrillers that you read on an airplane. Genesis actually requires a lot of time and attention. And as Professor Stanwood mentioned, there's actually, like, a lot of the stories are sort of small and standalone. So I in reading it, I would recommend people, read it in small doses. Read a few pages every day. And I think that's the way to really get the power of the text.
Yeah, that's a good thought. Mm-hmm. It's interpretive, isn't it, in a way? Mm-hmm. Can one be paradoxical? It's interpretive in a way that isn't really interpretive.
Mm-hmm.
It interprets, but yet it doesn't. It leaves so much to you.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, I think that's one reason why the text is so powerful, that it has these great stories, but then they're also open to many interpretations.
Yes.
You know, going back to Milton and much earlier, and Crumb is very much part of this, you know, long tradition.
Yes.
of offering another take on these venerable stories.
It's an astonishing and an amazing work, really.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good book. Sorry, I couldn't resist that one. Thank you so much to both of you, and I hope everyone goes out and checks out Genesis by Robert Crumb. Thanks, Jeet.
Thanks, it was great to be here.
Thanks, Dr. Sandwood.
Thank you.
All right. Up next, we have Japanese Music Whist.
The fence and the lane, the bus and the train, but an independent to make me look like I've got brains. I made a story up in my head, if anybody would ask. I'm going to a seminar, I'm a to be stuck, that's the way that things were going. The Bible's my tomb, there's no mention of school. My Damascus roads, my transistor radio. I tune in at night, when my mom and my dad start to fight. I put on my headphones and I tune. In the eye. That's why my only choice is find the face behind the voice.